Stedman Buttrick is being interviewed by Renee Garlick for Concord's Oral History Program. The interview is taking place on April 17, 1997. Mr. Buttrick is 67 years old. Oftentimes when people refer to the first families of Concord, they mean those that were at the North Bridge at the time of the Revolution, and certainly the Buttricks were there and probably before.
Oh, yes. William Buttrick, I think he was only 17 or 18, was in the first settlement of Concord. The charter granted, I guess it was a charter, anyhow, it was the group led by Peter Bulkley, who settled in Concord. And William Buttrick, whom we refer to in the family as the settler, was quite young. I suspect he was indentured. Indenturing wasn't slavery, it was very well accepted obligation that a younger person had to know, and very easily unshackled of it, and there were plenty of rules about it. It was no big deal, and one shouldn't look at these people as slaves. Well, William Buttrick settled in Concord, and he was the first to. I am now, well, my son, I suppose, is the last at this moment of a line of Buttricks that stayed in Concord. Now, there were many other Buttricks who did not. This is the same line that four generations later, I think, Major John Buttrick came along. So the Buttrick family's been in Concord since the beginning, at least my direct branch of it. And I think I'm the 10th. It goes William, Samuel, Jonathan, John, Major John, Jonas, the first Stedman, he's the 6th, William, 7th, Stedman, my grandfather, 8th, Stedman, my father, 9th, myself, Stedman, 10, my son, Sam, who doesn't live here at the moment, is the 11th, so now we got that straight.
Continuity.
Well, the fact is, if anybody wants to know about the Buttrick family, at least the male descendants, there's a book on it now. It was done by somebody I've never known named Richard Buttrick. He was in the Foreign Service, and after his retirement in the early 1970s, he has written a book called Buttrick, Buttrick, and Buttrick in America, because they're different spellings. That's why there are three Buttricks. So if anybody's curious about the Buttrick family, there's this book. I have it. Other members of the family have it. So they were, yes, I mean, you mentioned the old North Bridge. Well, they were there all right. We always, in my family, we always had a peculiar feeling about the old North Bridge. We accepted it. We had fact, the land was on our, that battle was really on our property. It was such a property in 1775. And I think, I don't know if it was my grandfather, I suspect it was. It could have been my grandfather deeded it to the town. Must have been my great-grandfather or even great-great, because by 1875, I think, centenary, a rather mixed-up bash that was, but anyhow, the land had been deeded to the town, the statute by Daniel Chester French, also a relative of mine on my mother's side. Oh, yes, indeed. I can't trace exactly. He's a Kai. My mother was a Kai, so Daniel Chester French was definitely on the Kai's side. Definitely, I mean, but I don't know what his relationship is to me.
From John Kai's, your mother?
My mother's father was George Kai's.
Oh, George,
actually.
Okay.
But John Kai's was around, too. I'm not so good on Kai's genealogy, but I know Daniel Chester French figures prominently in it. I mean, my mother knew him and so forth. My grandmother certainly knew him. So, the Minuteman, there it was, down there, and there were celebrations. And in fact, it was an additional celebration. And I think it was done by the Caledonian Society or something. Also, to decorate the graves of the fallen British soldiers there. That seems to have sort of vanished. But up to not too long ago, that was a regular event. Took place after the 19th of April, took place between the 19th of April and Memorial Day, generally, I think. Well, anyhow, living up there, right on top of it, we took a lot of history for granted. It was there, we knew about it, we were curious about it, but it didn't drive us, our lives. And it didn't bother us either, at least not until later on. And so I grew up in the 30s and 40s and into the 50s. You know, I was interested in the history. It was there, it was a part of us, but it wasn't a driving element, or whatever you want to call it, in my life or my development as from a childhood to adulthood. It was there, that's all it was.
We call it the Buttrick Mansion.
We've always bridled at the term mansion. We call it the homestead because that's the way it was in my grandfather's will, and he was the one who built it. It was built in 1911 and finished in 1912. The family lived in that used to be 74 Main Street. It's the last building of the Concord Academy on Main Street as you head west on Main Street. It was 74. It was number 74. It was a two-family house. It still is. Still has two front doors. But it was really quite a commodious place. And it has quite a lot of rooms out back and the land right down to the river. And that's where my father was born. That's where I think all the Buttrick children were born in my father's generation. And unfortunately, it has played quite a big role in the development of my father's generation. But his mother died giving birth. Their last child, final child there in 1909. And at that moment, my grandfather, he had no wife and look after, he was very busy at work and very successful at work. But his reaction was to drive himself harder at work as a kind of what my father described as an anodyne to his grief. He drove himself. At the same time, he decided he'd better build a real big place. He was getting on. He was going places. I mean, he was the first one in the whole history of the family that really became wealthy. Oh yeah, it was a simple, comfortable. They were land, they were big farm. And before that, small towns had many different jobs. My great-great-grandfather was treasurer of Middlesex County, and he defeated John Kies for it, as a matter of fact. The Democratic Party's always figured in the Buttrick family since the times of Andrew Jackson. The royalty persists, as a matter of fact. Anyhow, I think my grandfather thought he was deserving of a big place. He had enticed Russell Robb, who'd married, Edith Moss was her name, but Russell Robb was somehow related to the Buttrick family through the Bagleys. The Bagleys of Detroit. My grandfather married a Bagley, Olive Bagley, and she was the daughter of the governor of Michigan, John Judson Bagley. And then they enticed Russell Robb and his bride to move to Concord, and they were very close. Well, my grandfather decided to build this place up on Liberty Street. It was Buttrick land, and some houses were moved. Leonard Metcalf, who was a famous well-known engineer, Metcalf and Eddie. The firm still exists, I think it's just been bought out by a French company as of this moment. He pulled the house over from where the driveway is up there over to Monument Street, where the Boardman family lived for a long time, back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and into the 60s. I forget the number of it now, but it might be 430, 440 Monument Street. My house has moved. We did a lot in those days, apparently. Not much of my time, although it's been done. It was very common with horses and logs, roll logs. They did this pretty well. Well, he built the house. And there it was. I forget the name of the architect. I remembered it a few years ago, but I forget the name of it. But you can see his work all over Brookline and Chestnut Hill. He was a very well-known architect. And there was the house went up, and it was a lovely... The land had been in the family ever since settlement of Concord, so there's no question about having to buy land. He built this Georgian house. The cost of it was about $45,000, which is the house itself back then. And then it was high because they put a contract to Flannery, local land. Flannery is a contract. And he granted it just a lot of rock and everything. Didn't bother my grandfather. But there was a man who was so busy at work that he didn't have any mother. And he hired a housekeeper named Miss Pride, who was about a random place, and then there were the usual sort of governess. But the family were very close together. They had no mother. The brothers and sisters, the siblings bonded like that, very close, which was to be a...
What kind of work did your grandfather do?
Well, he went to attended Concord High School for 2 years, and then I think his father had been ill, and the family exchequer needed some help, and he went to work for, well, I think they were wool brokers or cotton brokers, and it was called Brewster and Cobb or something, and that business changed and became Brewster Cobb at Estabrook, and then became Estabrook Company. And in around just about the, just before he married, he was offered a part. He started off just as a writer or something. He was 16 or 17 years old, but he had a good sense. And he just had a good business sense and worked hard. And anybody who picked strawberries and things in the fields and about, they knew what hard work was about. And he just, marrying the governor of Michigan's daughter didn't hurt either of this, because he was in investment banking, and his role was the most important thing in those days. It was buying securities from expanding companies, manufacturers, utilities, and so forth, and reselling them to the public. It was the most important element of the business in those times. I mean, not stock salesmen, though they had bond salesmen. They were too common. Underwriting is really what the name of the game was.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what his skill was.
And he was Stedman.
He was Stedman, yes, mm-hmm. Yes. He had a brother, William, younger brother William, and a younger sister, Mary. Mary lived in Concord at a place called Overly, which is just below the Buttrick homestead, and was torn down. And that's where the battery fires from now and so forth. But there was a house there, stucco house, until mid-late 50s, my father had torn down. He wanted to expand the gardens down there. And he said it was full of termites. The house was perfectly good. He just didn't want it there. So, and he had a sister, Mary, brother William, who went into the utilities business and then moved back to Concord. Bill's name will come up from time to time. He moved back to Concord after working for the infamous Insull brothers, who expanded the utility industry that came crashing down when their pyramiding of holding companies just collapsed on them. But my grandfather always said, I'm told, that Insull contributed a great deal to this country, and he's been vilified parts of life. But anyhow, that's kind of a side issue.
How many acres did the
homestead have? Mm-hmm. But it was pretty well spelled out in my grandfather's will what the homestead constituted. It constituted all the obvious Liberty Street property, plus what they call the Major John Buttrick House, and the fields going up towards the Estabrook Woods. Now that was the homestead property.
Mm-hmm.
And it includes the Major John Buttrick House as it's referred to, although we never called it the Major John Buttrick House. I forget what house. I think we called it more like a, not Bartlett, but some other family house. But it was called out by the Major John Buttrick House.
So would you say it was 100 acres about, or more than that?
Well, I think it's, I think the place, property started on Liberty Street below Overly. This is pretty well defined because there's a stone wall that goes mm-hmm. all around. Down on that side of Liberty Street was only, I think, more like 28 acres. Now, mm-hmm. then the other side, going north, this was a lot more. I don't know. I think the total property was under 100 acres.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyhow, that's like, my father grew up in this house, and I was born in Boston. I wasn't born on a kitchen table at Buttrick Farm. No, I was born in Boston, but I lived there until I went to boarding school, and then I came back, and I was in college in Cambridge, and I was still getting home. So I'm quite good on memories up through to the early 50s, and I'm very bad on the 50s because I was in the service a long time and then living in Boston, so I do have many memories in the 30s and 40s, but 50s a bit spotty, I guess.
You must have loved the land.
We all loved the land. We liked the house. I think that my father and mother both thought the house was dull. Mm-hmm. In fact, later on, around 1946, Miss Mary Ogden Abbott, the good sculptor and artist and so forth, good, a very strong-willed person, quite eccentric at times, she gave my father a pretty good draftsman set. And he started to redesign the house that he wanted. And it was so grandiose, gosh, like flowing French doors and what those living rooms that would need two grand pianos to balance them. And I think they really just liked the house. Mm-hmm. They loved the site and the gardens and the grounds and everything. But I think both my mother and father just liked the house. And I think there's another reason why my mother did. So everybody in the Butcher family felt that they owned the house as much as my father and father did. And they did. And in fact, that was true. So whenever they wanted to come on, my father's sister from Milwaukee named Helen, she was called Flick, so I will refer to her as Flick. She got a guy named Bud Van Dyke. But whenever Flick came east, she felt she had a right to stay there for as long as she wanted. And she was a pretty strong person, too. But they were very close, my father and his brother and sisters. Extremely close. And I think that's the want of a mother. So it was very socially active at that house. His sister Olive came over 1939, this is June. She came with her son, two sons, a daughter, and a nanny. And her husband visited that summer but went back. They stayed with her 6 years.
Up from England?
Yes. Olive Buttrick, my father's sister, by an Englishman named Alexander Perrottis. And we were very close. They came home June of 39. They stayed with us for maybe a year, and then Olive rented a house around the Hobart House at the end of Powell Road. And then on Monument Street, which is 418 Monument Street now, where John Borden lives. And Ray Baldwin rented it then, and he was in Washington doing some government work, supposedly. And they lived there, but they lived over the 6 years.
There were a number of English children.
Oh, many. I've told you the Penn School was loaded with them at the time. And I went to Penn from grade 1 through 8. And around grades 5 and 6, we had a lot of English boys. Evacuees, they were called. And we made friends with many of them. Chris Davies was one of those. He still lives in Concord. Came back. I know my memories of the English in Concord are very clear. Very clear. I think my political awareness had arrived by then. My family were great New Deal Democrats, but I don't remember much of the domestic New Deal. Excuse me. I think that had petered out after the congressional elections of 1938. But boy, do I remember Roosevelt and foreign policy. And I think a lot of that was concerned because we were very, very much in favor of the antithesis of the America First. It was called Defend America by Aiding the Allies. And William Allen White, a newspaper editor of Emporia, Kansas, was the head of it. And it was kind of the counterweight to the America First. And you don't hear much about it, but it was very important. And people around it tended to sympathize to such a point that when Pearl Harbor was attacked and we received the news, there was a sign, it wasn't exactly a celebration, but it was not a great worry or apprehension, it was a relief.
Mm-hmm.
For us.
This was not a Franklin Roosevelt town conference.
Now it's very Republican, but there were many of the people who sympathized with his foreign policy. His father, well, Roosevelt could be a bit deceitful, but he was edging towards involvement all the time. Some say it was too slow, some say it wasn't fast enough, but the fact is you knew what he was doing. I knew as a boy of 10 what Roosevelt was up to.
Mm-hmm.
And so did we all, and we favored it. And Pearl Harbor was a relief. Finally we were in it. Should have been in a long time ago maybe, but now we're there.
And the town really rallied.
Yeah, oh yeah. But anyhow, I grew up in that place, and I remember that it all had a great attraction to the family and others, very active socially, people were always coming over. My old travels were spending the night there. Drove my mother crazy, but I didn't make it. Right there with the outbreak of the war, you know, Maynard Mills finally resuming production after having been shut down for this quite a number of years. Maynard Mills, it was hard to get help for the house. We were fortunate, we were able to find some people. But we had a lot of Finnish girls, and by God, when the American woolen mills reopened, they went right back. Where can they should have? And my father encouraged all the men on the property, but if good jobs were available there, the machine tool factories in Bridgeport, they should take them. So they were much better jobs than just, you know, outdoor work.
Your father had a great iris garden.
Oh, well, the garden started. Like the formal gardens, that is, if you were to walk up there today and have one of the National Park Service guides show you around. The upper garden was started, and the two formal upper gardens were started by my grandfather. Everything else was my father's expansion. The gardens were his baby. My grandfather liked them, but he was the one who took them off. There was some expansion in the late 30s and early 40s, but most of the lower terraces and the beds heading down towards what was Overly, this the former house and barn, but which is where the battery and others congregated in the 19th century. Most of that was his effort. And the place required a lot of, and you had to have five or six full-time men and then some part-time just to keep things going. And some of the guys were getting on, especially back in the 50s. You know, they were old and not terribly productive. And then we'd have part-time summer, especially in the gardens. Because the gardens were getting visited all the time. And my father took place in Irish competitions and so forth. So we were always having the horticultural society and something like that.
How did your home and the National Park Service get together with each other?
Oh, well, when my father and myself and another trustee decided this place was the manager, my father retired from business rather prematurely, and he couldn't handle it. He'd been handling it for years and years and years. He never owned a house. He was living there at the homestead, at the will of his siblings, and they wanted it. Oh God, I mean, they wanted, needed it there, but he never owned a house in his entire life. No. It's interesting. He was born in a house owned by his father. He lived, after he left Webster Father, he lived in houses owned by my mother's family, the Kai's family, and that's where he died, the Kai's family. He died 450 yards from where my mother was born. She died in the same house, in the same place. He lived three miles from where he was born. I mean, it was the same. He was very far-ranging intellect. But the rootedness in pockets of the stroke guy. He was a man who was sophisticated and educated. In every way a cosmopolitan person. Been taken from Congo. Now, as for the National Park, now, it was pretty simple. Our family lawyer was Ted Chase, who was also had been a Congo product. His father was Judge Chase for years, has a place over across the river on Monument Street down the lane, which is now some rich guy has it and has made it into a palace, but that was the Chase property. Judge Chase was a judge and then a lawyer in Boston, and Ted Chase grew up here, and went to Groton School and Harvard, but he settled in Dover. He married a Concord woman, too. Dorothea was a Newman, and the Newmans lived in Concord. Concord. So you see, he was a family advisor, and he knew Concord. And there'd been some rumblings at the National Park Service. The property, well, hell, here was the property. There was no doubt about it. They knew it, and we knew it. We had, so we proceeded to get an appraisal, the trustees had to get a present. We got a guy named Bobby Livermore, who was a very nice fellow, the Olympic Steel and all the rest of it, good real estate, but his appraisal was so pathetically low, he was looking upon it as a sale of a, well, maybe one or two properties. It's just ridiculously low. Well, we got just a local engineer named Lawrence Murray, who was his brother, Henry Murray, who was our head gardener, and he came up with a better plan. All we had to show the National Park Service is what we thought the place was worth on a limited sub-development. That's all. We had no intention of doing a limited sub-development. We had to, you know, they kind of try to obtain some sort of price reasonably close to the market. They were National Park Service, so that was a negotiable meeting. And it didn't take very long once we got going. And you've got the price, but it was ridiculously low. It was $600,000 or something, you know, which is huge for Concord in 1961 or whatever it was, 61. It was a big price.
Well, today, $600,000.
And it's nothing to say today. Well, that's another observation of mine that I had over time about houses in general, older houses. In the 30s, these places, big houses, were in disrepair. Now they're all spanking. And I'm referring to houses Hubbard Street, which has a lot of them, so forth. Up on Main Street in West Concord, as you head up this way, just down there the road, there's some good houses. They were all in shambles. Nobody gave a damn about them. And I think there's another reason. I think prosperity is one obvious reason for them to be in better shape, but I think it's an attitudinal thing. Nowadays, especially generations younger than me, look upon their homes as just another asset in their portfolio. The home is just it's an asset, and it's where they live, but they look upon it as an investment, perhaps, and they keep it up better. There's a different, really a different attitude about your home.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation. What year about did the National Park Service purchase?
62.
62, okay. Did they reach out to you as far as the first connection?
Well, no, because we knew Ted knew somebody who was in the service, and then we all came to Ted. It was all through Ted Chase was the middle man.
Mm-hmm.
And he was delighted. He wanted, it wasn't really a piece of legal business for him as much, although there was some legal business entailed there. But he was a Concord person, he wanted to see the right thing done too. It was more as a preservationist or conservationist that Ted's involvement was so important and interesting as well. He did a lot.
Then everyone in 62, like your father moved, you said in with Alice and George Kies?
No, they were dead. George was dead. No, he and my mother rented a house up on Monument Street for 6 months, owned by the Prescott Smiths.
Okay.
Prescott and Eloise Smith. Eloise is still alive, by the way. She's up in Newburyport. He died only a year ago. Then they moved into the Warren House on Estabrook Road, which was owned by my grandmother Kies. Then they moved in the house that she lived in once she died. And that was just down Liberty Street. From the corner. So you see how close they were. The Butchers and the Kaisers, they lived over the back fence. It was a long back fence, mind you, but it really was the closeness of this family. Not only the closeness of the Butchers, but the Butchers and the Kaisers, they all got along very well, too. My uncle, my father's younger brother, John, shot with Henry Kaiser. They used to hunting trips. Oh, it was just the bonded men. The really tight, tightly knit relationships is something we don't have anymore, and we don't have the sort of the common meeting place at Homestead. I miss that a lot. Social life was far more active and heady than it is now. Nobody hid in their homes as much. They were always out more.
Estabrook Wood, what can you tell me about that in terms of your family?
Well, I can tell you, I knew the Estabrook Woods as a jumble of different lots. And my grandfather was trying to tie them all together. You know, these lots, 10 acres here, 15 there, maybe 40 here, there. They sold for nothing. My grandfather had got very afraid to try to piece them together, get some contiguous, good-sized contiguous piece. And my father continued it. And there was a lot of swapping that my father had owned individually. He put it into the trust for a piece of this, so everybody could make more sense of this puzzle of lots up there. And I forget what the whole buttress ownership of the Estabrook Woods was, but when it came time to, and Harvard came along, and I think Ted was in on this act, Ted Chase. We were very happy to get this, because we saw development potential up there and problems. And we didn't, a bunch of families, I don't associate them as the most ardent conservationists, but when it came to land, they weren't too happy to see it developed. I thought they were ways of getting rid of it and maybe taking a bit of a financial sacrifice. But so you go around Concord these days, and except for a few houses up on Estabrook Road, lovely land, not very good houses, there's very little development of old Butcher property, practically none, really. Well, and we'll get to the Brewsters later, of course. But,
did you roam Estabrook Woods?
Yes, I would go. He was the one who was really for the pond, and Penn School used to skate on it from time to time. And we put a pond, that was about the only major development. There was a clay pit up there, which we used for a tennis court. I mean, the clay, sand and clay, we used to truck down with it. Put it on our tennis court, it's good clay. Actually, it really wasn't clay. John Borgman has another term, but it was a good mixture, anyhow, whatever it was. I knew the Estabrook Woods pretty well. The Robs had some nice contiguous land, including the Great Birch Meadow. And then we'd run into Emerson land further up and go, if we went far enough around, Hutchins land. Hutchins came there. So when we decided to put this together and sell it, it was a sale, but at a low price. I point out that most much of land transactions were sales because we had foreign beneficiaries and gifts didn't help them at all. They couldn't deduct them. So any budget transaction was a sale, generally, but a sale at a rather low figure, that's it. And
how did Harvard...
Harvard approached us, I think it was after Lyman. I remember Carlisle, Lyman was one of them. And they wanted, what they wanted for their biology department was a large tract of land that hadn't been trammeled, that hadn't been farmed, and nothing had happened much to it for a long time. And this was very suitable because nobody had farmed up there for years. It was poor land, it was swampy in some portions. So that went through very quickly. And some of that land banks right into Middlesex.
What time period did
The time period of that? Well, it came after the sale of the... Well, the time period's largely late 60s and early 70s.
Mm-hmm. I see.
And then the Rooster property came next.
Well, why don't you speak about that?
Well, this was a big property. This is my grandfather, in 1919, bought the entire Rooster's entire holding. Up there, including his house, his barns, his sheds, and his land. And, some of this land was a jewel of the property along the river.
Is that October Farm?
Yeah, well, October Farm was the house, but some of the land. And my Uncle John lived in the house for about 14 or 15 years, and it got sold to Mr. Gleason, to Funkhauser after Gleason, to Gustafson after Funkhauser, and then Louisa Gustafson, it was kind of broken up. Which state it is today, but all during this period, we owned all the land below Balls Hill Road, all down there. So even though October Farm had been sold, it was still land that we all owned in common. We, the beneficiaries of my generation, in effect, owned the land, because the previous generation was dead by then. And we decided the Wade Stanier was in part, Dick Perkins was part, were found a buyer for this, a single house, who did not want to break it up. It's only, it has built very little up there. It's actually did nothing for years. And that was a good sign. We loved the land. Another one of these deals where the money was, actually the money here was closer to the market, but one of these things where we could see it protected, held as one piece. And we knew Miss Engelhardt had no trouble since her father, who was a big, very wealthy man specializing in platinum and other rare metals. Engelhardt Industries, very important in that trade, still going.
Well, it certainly has given people so much enjoyment walking.
No, the house wasn't used. It was October Farm. Bella bought it in 1919 and it was never used until John moved in around 1928. Just sat there. Oh, my grandfather until he died, but go up there. Kids were having a party or something, or a debutante party, maybe, whatever. But it was never used until John. It was a lovely party. I liked it very much, and I know it very well, because I knew, of course, when John was up there, I was up there. I knew his children, and then I, later on, I knew Gus's very well, so I know the property anyway. It's a fine place. Now, I was sorry to see John leave it, as a matter of fact, but he felt it was just too much to keep up. He did a lot of it himself, and it was just getting tiring. I think it was during the war. Couldn't get people. So, these changes take place, but the essential landscape remains the same, I think, and, which is always pleasing to me.
Well, Estabrook Woods is certainly prime conservation land that's heavily used.
People walk through there now. They never used to. Funny, people take more interest in it. Brewster's always attracted more walkers down by the river. People canoe over from Bedford and so forth. There was much more activity down there, camping and so forth.
Now, you went to Middlesex?
No, I didn't go to Middlesex. No, I went to Exeter. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't here but doing some of the time. No, I went to Exeter. So my brother, young brother, went to Middlesex. I'll be very soon as I went to Middlesex. I went to Exeter. And I was there 4 years. I went to Harvard for 2 years. So I was out here. Here during a lot during the time I was at Harvard. Herb Wilkins and I were roommates my last year at Exeter. We've been very close ever since.
And now he's the state Supreme Court
the Chief Justice of the SJC now. So I'm delighted to have him there. Of course, he's going to have to retire in a few years, owing to mandatory retirement age, but I'm delighted he's there. He's followed the role of his father pretty much. And I'm very glad. I feel a little responsible for his having come to Concord, but he might have anyhow. His wife went to Concord Academy. But he knew my family well, and I think he can take a little credit for luring him
to Concord.
A little credit, not too much necessarily.
He was certainly very active in local...
He was a selectman and everything else. He was very active in town affairs. It wasn't until he got out of the court that, of course, he couldn't take place in it. Owing to ethical considerations, couldn't participate in any of these things. And once you're on the Supreme Court, if you got removed, you can push through any other, even volunteer activity, because it can so easily be twisted into a political thing.
You have been very interested in working on the library.
Yeah, but it's been about my only real intensive town interest. Chuck Peabody appointed me to the Housing Authority back when he was governor. That was my political payoff. Crazy. I had to get involved in that mess over White's Pond. It still hasn't been entirely cleaned up. Housing has never been a strong point in Concord. And low income or moderate income, they've always been a mess. The town has never come up with a comprehensive plan. We've always been behind the eight ball. Still are there.
Now tell me about the White Pond housing.
It's just a bunch of shacks that they wanted to upgrade them. And there was some government money. Most of the government money went to hire consultants in Cambridge. Nothing ever got done, and I'm not so sure that anything's completed now. I'm referring my embarrassment, really, about Concord housing is that we've never seriously come up with a comprehensive plan. We weren't willing to devote the money, I think it was to file with the taxes and so forth.
You were involved what time period?
Well, my involvement was much earlier. It was in the early 60s when that Chuck Peabody was governor. Mm-hmm. That's what I was on there, yeah.
And your involvement with the library?
Well, that's been much longer lasting. My father had served on the library a long time, and when David Little was thinking of retiring, he wanted me to come on and succeed him, and several years later as president of the library, which I did, but I found I couldn't handle the job too well because you have to be around too much. Mm-hmm. I was in Boston. The president of the library has to be available locally.
The Library Corporation.
Corporation, I'm referring to. Mm-hmm. No, because the corporation is a private corporation. It's a function. It has nothing to do with appointments from the town or something. You know, the corporation essentially owns the building and has mm-hmm. an investment portfolio. It owns two buildings, the Fowler and the main library, and has a pretty good sized investment portfolio. That's for corporations. And I've served on it. I mean, I've always thought that having continuity was important. Of course, I know how long I've been there, 30 years, over 30 years now, and that may be too much continuity, but it's good to have someone around who, as people come and go, who've been there and understands has a memory for one thing, and mm-hmm. remember things that happened a few years back and make sure they're not duplicated, like a study for energy or something.
So you are...
But I've been the treasurer of the thing, I've been the president mm-hmm. of the thing, now I'm just plain old individual trustee there, but I like it, and I enjoy the meeting. In fact, I've got one tonight at the corporation. And our library is unique. It has extraordinary turnover of books and so forth. It's very busy for a town of this size. It's a very special institution in this town. It needs a lot of attention and a lot of expansion as well. Tourism in this town seems to be an issue of the moment at the visitor's center. There's nothing new about that. Ideas for visitor centers have been tossed around for years and years. Tourism is going to have a problem. I told you about my idea of being Rip Van Winkle up around Hutchins Pond and then driving down. I actually walked some of it. I found that, as I walked down Monument Street, really there were very few changes. The same old buildings are there in somewhat better shape, somewhat expanded. Wonderful clearing done by the Bemis family and the Robb family. You get terrific business. And I approve of that because I've been arguing with the National Park Service that they've got to do a lot of tree cutting. It's getting far too dense. It's been my major argument with them about the way they maintain the place.
And what did they say?
Too expensive. Well, I know it's awfully expensive. I'm sympathetic with them, but it's got to be done. No, I think there's some foolish attitudes about preserving trees. There's a lot of preservationist feeling gets silly after a while, but especially when it comes to trees. When it comes to a town, it's a different thing. Traffic is going to strangle this town one of these days, though, unless something happens. It's just gone. Access to Route 2 at times is impossible. The center of town is jammed at least twice a day by the Maynard Bedford Burlington access, and the inner town is going to be, there has to be some way of rerouting, but on the other hand, Route 2 is almost at full capacity. Mm-hmm.
That's probably one of the striking differences.
The major difference is traffic mm-hmm. lights and so forth. Oh, and hidden there, you're going to find garden apartments and condominiums and so forth, but I think traffic's going to strangle this place before too long. Population growth has not been extraordinary if you go back to the town. I remember running the town in the 1940s being 7,500 and something or other. What are we now, 17 maybe? Well, we were there. I think the population went down for a while, mm-hmm. and it's coming back. In population. You want to look at a mismanaged town, all you have to do is go up to Acton. There you can see a mess. The town that never had any cohesiveness and it just fell apart.
We always credit our Maynard, because Milldam, well, Milldam was nice, but it's terribly inadequate as far as shopping is concerned. We needed Maynard in the old days, and now we got the malls in Acton or Bedford or Burlington. So Concord doesn't, Concord's lucky that other people do these things for us. We never had a movie theater in Concord except during the Second World War when they set up one of the veterans buildings. It was terribly uncomfortable, but got first-run movies. I saw Casablanca there for the first
time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. On a sweaty summer night, yeah.
And you don't forget that.
Yeah, that's right.
We're approaching Patriots Day.
Well, we certainly are. We're having it now, the day after tomorrow, and it's on the true date. Yeah, I think I'll go this year. I'm usually at work.
Is that something that has been the continuity, the tradition?
Yes, and it's a good one. Yeah. My grandfather felt it, too. He had a stroke in 1921, early 22. And for several years thereafter, he'd go out to a big, big place. The Hotel Del Coronado, which was just off San Diego Island, Coronado Island, off San Diego. We'd leave right after Thanksgiving, and he'd be back by the 19th of April, I mean, important dates. The 19th's always been important to us. I don't think it was just, I don't think people realize how important the 19th of April was to the world. I'm not really just a town of Concord or to the city or the region. There is some local historian around here who was writing a crabby letter to the journal maybe 5 years ago saying, well, this 19th of April was a nothing event. It was just a little skirmish. It meant nothing. Well, just as I forget who the guy was, he's a local guy, anyhow, he's supposed to be a professional historian, but at the same time, I was reading a long article by Henry Fairley. Now, Henry Fairley was one of those Brits who was like Alastair Cook, very pro-American and very loyal to the United States. And I don't know if he became a citizen like Alastair Cook, but he was very pro-U.S. And he wrote a long article about how the 19th of April got covered in the news reports in Europe and had royalty quaking and had Catherine of Russia sending letters of commiseration to King George III. Now, this was an important thing. It should be remembered that way. The battle, I mean, it shouldn't be described as a huge battle. It was a skirmish and a very difficult retreat for the British. In fact, they almost got, they should have been cut off. They should have never been allowed to get back to Charlestown. What's his name up there? Pinckney. The guy up in Salem should have had his troops down there earlier. The British could be cut off. They could all have been captured. Didn't quite make it. Pickering was in there, the guy who was commanding the Minutemen militia up on Salem. They could have shut the British off. But anyhow, that's an ex post facto stuff. But the 19th of April was an important event for us, but for the world too.
Well, thank you.